Public Radio.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As you no doubt have heard, the long-debated sequestration officially kicked in over the weekend, and federal managers today are starting to draw up furlough notices for their employees. The sequester refers to the automatic, across-the-board, $85 billion worth of spending cuts that will now go into effect. According to state-by-state numbers from the Obama administration, in New Hampshire, the sequester will hurt an array of programs that receive federal funding. These include $1 million for K-12 public education, $1.5 million for clean air and clean water, and more than $200,000 for meals provided to senior citizens. In addition, 6,000 Granite State government workers' jobs are threatened with furloughs and pay cuts. But these claims that our fiscal sky is falling have been criticized, and not just by Republicans, but also some major media outlets. For example, the Washington Post said that the sequester spin was getting ahead of reality and that many of the president's predictions were guesswork at best. Part of the problem is no one really knows how federal agencies will adjust to these reductions or how long the cuts will be in effect in case the president and Congress do reach an alternative deal. Today in The Exchange, the conflagration over sequestration. We'll look at the impact here in New Hampshire. Let's hear from you. How concerned are you about the effect of these cuts on your own life or on the state overall? Do you think that the gloomy forecasts are exaggerated and we won't see much change? Do you think that the sequester could have an upside in that it's finally a way to attack the federal debt and deficits? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests with us. Dante Scala is here, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH, also a fellow at UNH's Carsey Institute. You can follow him on Twitter at GraniteProf. And Dante, thanks for your time.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Charlie Arlinghouse, President of the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, a free market think tank based in Concord. And Charlie, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dennis DeLay, economist at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. And Dennis is also New Hampshire Forecast Manager for the New England Economic Partnership. And Dennis, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Laura. Thanks.
Well, and Dennis, since you're our economist, we'll start with you. It's worth spending a few minutes reminding everybody how we got here. Seems like every time you turn on the radio, there's a story about a fiscal cliff or a sequester or something like that.
Yeah. Well, again, if you want to go back a couple of years, in the summer of 2011, there was an attempt to try to deal with the federal deficit, both in terms of raising revenues and cutting expenditures. Without going into it too much detail, that deal essentially fell through, and the fallback position was what became the so-called fiscal cliff that we were dealing with in December and now sequestration. If you recall, again, in December or early January, deal was essentially cut on the revenue side, but nothing was done on the spending side. And the so-called spending side, or the automatic defense cuts, are called sequestration. And now here we are, as of the end of last week, there was no deal cut on these automatic spending cuts, and now they've essentially are going into effect.
And why are these often called, Dennis, dumb or clumsy or not the best way to cut deficits?
In an economist's point of view, well, simply because they are automatic cuts across the board to various government programs without any consideration of whether it's a good idea to cut defense more than social programs or not. In a way, it's sort of similar in the reverse to what happened with the stimulus. You know, in that case, there was about close to $800 billion worth of spending that was pushed through the initial sort of funding sources without any consideration of whether, you know, it was a good idea to increase CDBG by an X amount of dollars or not.
It's
now we have something plans, like right? that in the reverse. It's $85 billion in cuts that have to occur over the next year or so. So it's about a 10% difference between the stimulus that we saw in 2009 and the cuts that we're seeing right now.
And one more quick question for you, Dennis, and then I want to bring the other gentleman in. You mentioned defense cuts. What else is covered by the sequester and what isn't? Because from what I understand, Dennis, there are some chunks of federal spending, some large chunks of federal spending that are untouched by this.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's about 85% of federal spending that isn't touched by the sequester.
85%? Wow.
Yeah, Medicaid is not part of it, 82%. Medicaid is not part of it.
Medicare,
Social Security, TANF, SNAP, which is sometimes called the food stamp program. So programs like that, fairly large entitlements, aren't part of the sequester. The things that are some of the smaller programs, community development block grants. I went by a Head Start bus on the way over here this morning, and I thought to myself, okay, that's a program that could potentially be cut by the sequester. And programs on the defense side. For instance, some of the folks over at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard are a little bit concerned about what's going to happen if they're furloughed, which actually is probably not going to start till next month in April.
Right. Okay. Well, and Dante Scott, let's bring you into it, too. Dennis did a great job describing the economics. What about the politics of that, Dante? Untangle that for us, how each side is trying to gain the upper hand here.
Yeah. I think one thing to keep in mind is that the deficit is – matters a lot more to partisans than it does to the public at large. That is, for instance, when George Bush was president, Democrats said the deficit is a very high priority and we should all be very concerned about it. Now that Democrats in the White House, Democrats no longer think the deficit's a big priority, but Republicans do. So the deficit tends to be this issue that plays with partisans against the party in power. The public cares much more about the economy than it does about budget deficits. I mean, if for instance, the 2012 election were all about deficits, I doubt Barack Obama would have a second term in office. But he does because the public cares more about the economy than about deficits. The public is also, by and large, rather ignorant about the budget and about what would need to be done to truly get it into order. You've got about half the American public saying if the federal government only cut out waste, fraud, and abuse, then we'd basically be on the right track. Now, I'm not saying there's no waste, fraud, or abuse in the federal budget, but the idea that if you just did that, it would basically take care of itself as opposed to much more painful cuts such as to entitlement programs. So you've got a public that's, you know, doesn't know a lot. And they're very malleable about this particular issue.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, it's real easy to blame those darn politicians in Washington who can't reach agreement, can't get a deal. And we've heard a lot of that over the weekend of the public saying, get your act together, folks. But to what extent, Dante, are those elected people reflecting what we the people want?
Well, I mean, the public's not going. Yeah, I think that's a fair point. The public's not going to want to make these painful cuts to entitlement programs unless, I mean, but that's what politicians are supposed to do. They're supposed to lead the debate. And if politicians keep saying it's all about waste, fraud, and abuse, well, guess what? The public's not necessarily going to go investigate and find out differently. So there is this kind of leadership deficit here and lots of finger pointing in place. But it's certainly true. The public is kind of getting the government, or at least the budget deficit that it asked for.
I'd love to get your take on all this, Charlie Arlinghouse, both the economics that Dennis described and some of the politics that Dante described.
Well, I think it all boils down to a sort of a lack of leadership and a lack of ability of our elected officials to perform, to function as they ought to function. I mean, if we were to fire everybody in Congress and start over, nobody would really miss them. They would all miss themselves, and they all think they're irreplaceable. The sequester and the fact that we have it is, in fact, a sign of what a pathetic job they're doing. It is a ham-handed mechanism that is designed to function only in the case in which they don't act as we expect them to. In fact, sequesters started, people remember Graham Rudman after Senator Warren Rudman, our senator. Their deficit was enormous at the time, although a fraction of what it is today. But it was considered too big, and we needed to lower it. And he put us on a glide path and said, all right, every year we pass a budget. They used to pass budgets back then. Every year we pass a budget, we're going to pass a lower and lower deficit until we get to balance. If we don't meet that target, there's an automatic mechanism that will kick in. It was when they used the word sequester first.
So this has been around for a while, dating back to the days of Warren Rudd.
Yeah, dating back to the mid-'80s. And so if you don't act, we're going to – and the thought was that to cut everything across the board was so rough that politicians would naturally act. And, in fact, it worked. It worked so well, deficits started going down fairly significantly. And it worked so well that some politicians didn't like it because they had to cut spending. So they cut a deal, and one of the focuses of the 1990 budget deal was, in fact, to get rid of Graham Rudman. That came back. A lot of us have talked about – I've actually written about this, I think, three or four times in the last 5 years about let's bring back something like that, because politicians cannot be expected to act by themselves if we don't have a club that's about to knock them over the side of the head. And this was the club. And so they created it, and they said politicians will never let this happen. It'll be such a horrific thing out there that they'll be forced to act. And each side thought they'd be forced to act. And, you know, and – I guess by now we know, and although Bob Woodward's in trouble over this, that it was the president's idea originally, but he thinks now he wants to distance himself from it. But Republicans didn't think it was a horrible idea. They thought it was a great idea, too. And so they went along with it, and now they're saying – but the thought was that we would act. It's not a perfect thing, because the problem with spending, as Dennis points out, is about two-thirds of our spending is entitlement or mandatory programs.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking, the picture he painted, that so much of the federal budget isn't even affected by this.
It really isn't. And if you look at the effect of the budget cuts in the first year, in fiscal 2013, will be approximately $42, $43 million, according to the Congressional Budget Office. And I think something like $7 million of that is from entitlement programs, and $35 million is from everything else. There are a couple small programs that are affected, although the big ones aren't. But this isn't going to make a huge difference. In fact, over 10 years, this will cut, if it isn't eventually replaced, it would cut a total of about just under $1 trillion, $995 billion off of the total we are going to spend for 10 years, which is $47 trillion. So this would cut a grand total of about 2% of total spending and still leave us with historically high deficits, a growing federal debt that is threatening our economy.
So, and I definitely want to follow up on that point after a short break, Charlie. There are some people saying, hey, look, there's an upside to sequestration, that it gets the federal government on the path toward deficit reduction, toward managing the debt a little bit better. We'll talk about that after a break. We'll start taking your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477. We want your questions, comments, concerns about sequestration, 1-800-892-6477, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And more on frustration over sequestration coming up on The Exchange and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, dealing with the sequestration fallout. One in five households in the country carry student debt. NHPR's news director Sarah Ashworth will be exploring the ins and outs of this widespread issue in New Hampshire. She'll be moderating a panel of experts at Manchester's Community College on March 7th. Visit NHPR.org for more information. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Grupponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Grupponi Auto Junction in Bow, and online 24 hours a day at grupponi.com. And from Mascoma Savings Bank, serving the people in needs of the Upper Connecticut River Valley since 1899, online at mascomabank.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at sequestration, reaction to the fact that these automatic spending cuts kicked into effect over the weekend. We're looking at the impact here in New Hampshire and getting your thoughts. How concerned are you about the effect of these cuts on your own life, on programs you may work on, or on our state overall? Do you think that some of the gloomy economic forecasts are exaggerated and we won't see much impact or not? Do you think there could be a bright side to the sequester in terms of attacking federal deficits and debt? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. One more time, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And Dennis DeLay, back to you. Picking up on something that Charlie Arlinghouse said, said just before the break that these cuts are over 10 years. So they sound big, but they are over 10 years. Mm-hmm. The New York Times pointed out that with the sequester and other earlier budget deals, plus saving on the debt from those deals, because your overall debt payments go down, the U.S. is almost at the $4 trillion in deficit reduction that many economists say would be optimal. Again, this is over 10 years. So, Dennis, why aren't more people saying hooray for the sequester?
Well, I think there are, as you point out, there are a few people that are saying hooray for the sequester. The Congressional Budget Office is one of them. They've actually done a couple of papers or several papers now sort of saying that the sequester may not be that bad an idea because, for number one, again, as you say, it does do a little bit, not a lot, but it does a little bit towards lowering the deficit to GDP ratio for the country. Its total impact of the sequester is actually going to be fairly mild by some standards. It's probably going to cause about 0.5% drop in gross domestic product this year, which would probably translate into about 700,000 jobs lost, which is not great news by any means, but it's not a very large impact on the economy and certainly nowhere near the kind of impact we had from the Great Recession. And then the other thing is that again, as Charlie was said so well, the whole idea of the sequester itself is so anathema and frankly stupid that
again,
maybe,
because you can't do it with an eye towards
right,
what works and what doesn't.
Right, because you can't do it with an eye towards making the kind of cuts that you probably should intelligently in various types of programs, that it might open the door towards a more intelligent way of going about this. One of the things that a number of economists have advocated for a while is instead of setting deadlines or timelines, set targets. In other words, we'll do something like this when the unemployment rate gets to around 6%, or we'll do something like this when the economy is growing at 4% a year. That's the time to start thinking about raising revenues and cutting entitlement spending, but to sort of set, as we have in the sequester or in the fiscal cliff, sort of set a deadline and say, okay, by December we're going to do this, is not an intelligent way to go about things. The Federal Reserve, as for instance, when it sets monetary policy, sets targets. We're going to set interest rates at this level until we see inflation rise to about 3%, as an example. And that's probably a more intelligent way to do these things.
Yeah, and I know you want to jump in, Dante, and then Charlie, I have another question for you. Go ahead, Dante.
Yeah, I mean, Dennis and Charlie are absolutely right. And I think elites in Washington agree. I mean, Barack Obama, Speaker Boehner, Kelly Ayotte, Gene Shaheen, they all think this is a stupid idea. But the Senate had a couple of votes on alternatives last week. The Republican alternative got 38 votes out of 100. Democrats got 52, which wasn't enough to get over the 60-vote barrier need to do anything in the Senate these days. So politicians decided that however stupid this was, it was preferable to the alternatives. I mean, compared to all the drama in January that we saw about the fiscal cliff and the debt ceiling and all these backroom deals and Joe Biden to the rescue, last week was pretty quiet. I mean, there really was no big effort to try to solve this. And why? Because on the one hand, Democrats preferred this sequester to significant cuts in social spending that would affect, say, Social Security payments to seniors. Okay. They looked at those two alternatives. They said, this is better. On the Republican side, after January and raising taxes once, they absolutely were not going to do that again. So again, the alternative, stupid, was preferable to what else was possibly on the table. So this is where they wound up.
Well, and one more question, and then I do want to go to our listeners. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments, concerns about sequestration, 1-800-892-6477. Charlie, I do want to hear from you, though, on this idea that the sequester could shave off as much as 1% of GDP. Now, there's different estimates out there, as Dennis said, but what do you think?
Well, generally speaking, any change to any reduction in the deficit, any reduction in spending is going to have a short-term negative for GDP and a long-term positive for GDP. And the reverse is also true, that an increase in the deficit may have a short-term positive for GDP, but will have a long-term negative for GDP. What we're trying to do is balance those two things. The deficit is a problem. Our growing debt, I mean, our debt is at a ridiculous level now, the highest it's been since the World War II buildup. And we're not fighting World War II. And it's a problem, and it's a problem that you can see the result of in places like Greece and Italy and Spain and Ireland. And
it destabilizes your whole financial system, yeah, your standing in the world, and so
and
forth.
And we have to, you know, the problem for us is there's no United States for us. The saving grace for a lot of Europe is there's still a United States, but if we go, there's nobody left. So we have to be careful about that. So we have to balance short-term and long-term. Is there going to be some short-term negative for this? Yeah, there is. And in some areas more than others. It's something to look at. Why is everybody in New Hampshire so concerned about it? Jean Shaheen Kelly Ayotte, for example, is the defense industry is very much affected by this, probably worse than any other industry in the country.
BAE Systems in Nashua, Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, those are the two biggies, right?
Exactly.
Sally?
And the areas that are affected most are things like research and development. The areas that New Hampshire benefits most from are the areas of defense spending that are affected the most. They're also affected, by the way, by the fact that we keep not having a budget that has impacts on the procurement process, which affects most non-government defense employers. So that's an impact. Will it affect some jobs in the short term? Yes, but hopefully that will benefit some jobs in the long term as well. And as Dennis says, 700,000 jobs. Keep in mind that the U.S. employment is about 142 million, roughly, people. Mm-hmm. So again, it's about a 0.5%. Did I just do that math right? Yes, 0.5% of the total jobs in the country.
All right, lots more to talk about, gentlemen, but let's bring our listeners into this. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And first up, gentlemen, is Paula in Springfield, Vermont. Hi, Paula, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I'm just an average voter, and I just see this, the problem is that the entitlements, yes, are a problem and they need to be dealt with. But first, in order for us to take care of the entitlements, we need to take care of waste, fraud, and closing the loopholes. And Congress needs to pull together and stop acting like their enemies. We're here, we're voting, we do want to help out, but they need to help as well. And maybe they don't deserve to have a raise. And maybe the people that are suffering the most aren't the ones who to be giving more and more and more. We need to see something from them as well.
Okay, Paula, a couple thoughts from that call. Dante Scala, she referred to waste, fraud, loopholes. You talked about that earlier.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another thing. I mean, there's... A year or two ago, there was talk about a grand bargain between the president and Congress that would include a broad tax reform, much like what was passed during Ronald Reagan's second term in office. And that would include closing a lot of the tax loopholes that Paula talked about. But that now seems off the table. I mean, this idea of a grand bargain which seemed to have a lot of life a couple years ago, seems by the boards now because Republicans seem, again, kind of determined this – we're not crossing that line again. We're not going to raise taxes again. And there's this interesting dynamic between Speaker Boehner and his delegation in the House of Representatives where Speaker Boehner has let some votes go by with just a minority of Republicans signing on to them. And I think – now that's at an end. So it's tough to see how that's all going to play out in a way that would satisfy what Paula would like to see. And I suspect a lot of voters as well.
Well, and here's a quote from Speaker Boehner on Meet the Press over the weekend, referring to what you just said, Dante. Speaker Boehner said, "The president got his tax hikes on January 1st, referring to the $600 billion in taxes that came out of Washington's last fiscal crisis. Boehner said, the issue here is spending. Spending is out of control. There are smarter ways to cut spending than the silly sequester." And this is quoting him now, the silly sequester that the president demanded. Another question for me that comes out of Paula's question, and Paula, thanks for calling. Dennis DeLay, entitlements need to be dealt with, Paula said. Why aren't entitlements on the table in this sequester, given what you said earlier, that, you know, 80% of the budget is off the table here.
Well, again, Ed, you know, the harder thing to do, frankly, is to tackle Social Security to some extent, although most of the calculations I've seen suggest that Social Security in its current form can pay benefits well into 2040. It's really Medicare, and therefore it's really healthcare spending that's at the root of all of this. And again, at the Center for Public Policy Studies, we've done a couple of reports, and I know you've had us on, Steve Norton, my boss, on to talk about the silver tsunami and the idea that as the population ages, we're going to see increasing pressure on healthcare spending and healthcare costs. And that's the real issue. It's really Medicare. And we can't get Medicare under control until we get healthcare costs under control. And frankly, no one's been able to figure out how to do that.
So it's just too hard.
It's just too hard. And then the other side of this is there's always going to be an advocate for some kind of tax break or some kind of subsidy. As what an economist once said, and I can't remember who it was, you'll never get rid of the mohair subsidy. you know, there'll always be a mohair lobby somewhere that'll be, you know, advocating for some kind of a tax break for people that produce that, you know, good or service. So that's the other difficulty is you know, getting into the weeds and trying to figure out what subsidies and what entitlements have probably overlived their usefulness is a difficult thing to do.
Well, and Paula, thanks for the call. Our number 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Mike in Hillsborough. Also, Mark in Rochester has a similar question, but I'll read Mike's email. He says, whatever pain sequestration inflicts on the average American, I can tell you one group which will be exempt from the suffering, our congressional representatives, when they fashion this legislation, deliberately crafting it as a, quote, nuclear option. They specifically exempted themselves from its effects. So while many of us will endure reductions in pay, job layoffs, reduced services, Congress will, as usual, be sitting pretty. Mike says, they work for us. Shouldn't we demand that they cut their own pay by the 10% mandated in the sequester? Maybe that would force them to act like adults and do their job again. Similar sentiment from Mark in Rochester and Charlie Ellinghaus. A similar sentiment from our caller, Paula.
I agree. I agree 100%. And, of course, it won't ever happen because the people who would have to vote for that to make things apply to Congress are the people in Congress. And in there,
most of them millionaires anyway, though. I mean, aren't we hearing surveys that, you know,
I think most,
80% of senators are millionaires?
Most senators, I think the majority of senators are millionaires. I think not the majority of House members.
I see.
Or something like that. I mean, but they're all doing okay.
But the sense that I
get
from
these
emails,
by the way, let's get this straight. They're making $175,000 a year.
Not too bad.
To dock them to, you know, 160 isn't exactly forcing them onto welfare.
I take it.
And exactly. I think, you know, there have been a couple of bills like this. There's a, you know, Senator Ayotte, I think, is a co-sponsor of the No Budget, No Pay bill. If you can at least pass a budget, we don't get paid. I've suggested that some form of deficit reduction would be to pass a bill that says that every $100 million or whatever you want of deficit is a percentage off of your pay. It would incentivize them to balance the budget by whatever means necessary.
Yeah, and the sense that I get from these emails and again from Paula is, Dante, that people are mad. They're mad that Congress couldn't get together on this.
We'll see.
See how mad they really are?
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of rhetoric last week and, you know, from both sides. I mean, the president was bringing out a page from Bill Clinton's playbook in the 1990s that, well, if we do this, there's going to be, you know, all hell to pay and things are going to go into chaos, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I think Americans waking up this morning probably looking around saying, well, you know, the sky hasn't fallen yet. I mean, that doesn't mean there's not going to be significant problems and that this is no way to run a government. All that's true. But again, I don't know that the public, by and large, is inflamed by this issue as much as people who are following intently. I mean, it's. I would think most Americans are a lot more concerned about unemployment and unemployment rate than about sequestration.
Well, and I also wonder, you know, they just keep going from crisis to crisis and fiscal cliff to fiscal cliff. And maybe at some point, Charlie or Dennis jump in on this, people just kind of tune it out, right, Charlie? I mean, what do you think?
At some point, you're the boy who cried wolf. There was a crisis 3 months ago. There's a crisis now. There's another crisis 3 months later. The rhetoric for weeks has been huge, but it's all rhetoric on all of those shows on TV that no one watches, right? That everybody who's already decided and paying a lot of attention watches Meet the Press and Fox News and CNN and MSNBC. But normal humans don't really care as much about that. And one way we can tell that is that the president said, I think it was on Friday in a press conference, he started walking back and saying, you know what, we now know the results of it because we knew it was going to happen at that point. The results of it aren't really that bad. And instead, I'm going to focus on universal pre-K or whatever it is he's doing and other things that were in his State of the Union address. When the biggest politicians start moving on, it's a sign that the people didn't actually care.
Dennis, real quick from you and then back to our callers.
Well,
Lots of calls coming in.
Just going to mention that, you know, there's another crisis coming up, by the way, folks, and it's going to be March 27th when the continuing resolution that funds the government expires. So that's a point where lawmakers are going to have to approve a budget through the remainder of the fiscal year, which ends on September 30th. So, you know, again, I wish we could say that we probably won't be back here in about 3 weeks, but we might be.
All right, let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Jeremy in Goffstown. Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Good morning to your panel as well. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to preface my question just by briefly stating that I am registered independent, but not only registered, I am fiercely independent. I'm very socially liberal and very fiscally conservative, which means for people like me, I feel like I don't really have real representation in Congress. You know, it's either all of one or all of another. excuse me. So my question is, you know, I get a lot of comments and read a lot of updates on Facebook and social media and other venues, and they all seem to be very emotionally driven statements that claim to be information about what the sequester is or is not doing. I'd like to know, where can I get actual information that is correct and factual about this whole situation? All I'm hearing from, you know, the politicians is emotionally driven statements, and a lot of fact checking is turning out the, you know, most of those statements out to be false.
Yeah. Jeremy, we're heading into a break, so I'm going to let you go. Thank you for the question. Dante?
Now, I was going to mention one name. Ezra Klein writes a very good public policy blog for The Washington Post called Wonk Blog, W-O-N-K-B-L-O-G, and that's worth reading.
Yeah. Charlie?
It is worth reading, although worth noting that for people out there, Ezra's in fact quite liberal, so conservatives will say, oh, you know, whatever. But CBO.gov is a congressional budget office. They publish regularly in great detail on all of these things, and if you want actual honest-to-God numbers, I would look there.
One of the few institutions that everybody still trusts these days, Charlie, I think, correct?
I think so.
All right. We will take more of your calls after a short break. Jeremy, thanks for that one. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from the Neve Network organizations working with the New Hampshire Department of Education to increase the college aspirations of local students at IamCollegeBound.org. And North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million-dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings on time, on budget, online at Facebook, LinkedIn, and NorthBranch.net. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR Spring Membership Drive starts Wednesday as we try to get a day's worth of contributions in just 3 hours. When we meet that goal, we'll earn a $10,000 challenge grant from a generous Upper Valley donor, and you can help by giving a dollar a week, a dollar a day, or something in between. Your gift today will count towards that first day goal, that $10,000 challenge, and it will help us bring you more news with less on-air fundraising. Give online now at nhpr.org, and thanks.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, sequestration frustration in the Granite State. We're taking a look at what the cuts that have now been kicked into effect may mean for us here in New Hampshire. We're looking at the economics and politics of this. And we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, here's an email that came in from Kathy, who says, on the exchange this morning, I understand that your guest said that Medicare was not impacted. On the contrary, Kathy says Medicare payments to healthcare providers are impacted by a 2% cut. For New Hampshire's hospitals, that 2% cut is $41 million in lost reimbursements over the next 10 years. Kathy, thanks a lot for that clarification. Dennis, do you want to jump in there?
No, that's actually right. I probably misspoke. I mean, Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program are off the table. They aren't part of the sequester. But
and again,
is,
Medicaid, just to clarify, is health insurance for the poor.
And it's essentially a state, half state, half federal government program.
Right.
So that... that is off the table, but Medicare, there is going to be a small – it's limited to 2%. And again, I'm sure advocates for, you know groups that are essentially experiencing the cuts will think that any cut is an important one. But we are talking about a 2% limit. And again, $41 million over, 10 years is – honestly, not a big number.
Although New Hampshire hospitals in particular, as you know, Dennis, having crunched the state numbers,
right,
have been feeling kind of under siege lately.
They have. And again, that's it's tied to the Medicaid entitlement enhancement tax,
right,
and
there's a lawsuit
the disproportionate
over this
share.
And...
So, I mean, again, there has been pressure on healthcare providers to try to control costs, but that essentially goes back in part to what I was talking about earlier. I mean, if you look at healthcare costs, and again, we're not doing a show on them right now, but they have been rising more than the rate of inflation. There's a lot of reasons for that. Some of it is tied to population growth. Some of it's tied to increase access to care or the overall, complications associated with care. But most of it is tied, frankly, to price increases and to increases in technology. And those things that are things that we really do have to get a handle on if we're going to address some of the larger issues, including Medicare, going forward.
Let's take another call. And this is Jake in Milford. Hi, Jake. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Good.
Good. Great panel today. My question has to do with, I like your guest comments a little bit. Our politicians in Washington don't want to talk about what the future holds for us if we continue on our current path. Currently, the interest on the federal debt is like 7% of our federal expenditures. Discretionary spending is only 6%. So interest is definitely crowding out other stuff that we want to do. If we don't deal with this debt and deficit, what do they see for the future of our economy?
So you're one of the folks, Jake, who's kind of saying hooray for the sequester. It's about time?
Well, I think you guys were on target when you talked about the Graham Rudman. If we had stayed with that, where would we be today versus where we are now? And what would our government be able to do if their hands weren't tied with this monstrous federal debt?
Okay, Jake, thanks a lot for the call. Charlie.
There are a couple things. He's right about insurance payments being
interest payments.
Interest payments being a relatively large percentage of the budget.
And his description that these interest payments are crowding out what we want to do.
Well, every dollar you spend, this is less true in Washington because they don't seem to accept any limit on their ability to spend money. But every dollar you spend, in theory, crowds out your ability to spend a dollar on something else. Interest is at an all-time low, though. It's worth noting that interest rates are as low as they will ever be in our history, and they will never be lower. So the caller... in fact, raises an alarm that should be even louder. Interest rates are going to go up at some point. The economy starts recovering, and our percentage of the budget that covers is going to increase and increase and increase. It's going to put greater pressure on the budget than we have now, and that's something worth noting. If Graham Rudman happened, where would we be now? Well, we'd have balanced the budget before Bill Clinton balanced the budget. Bill Clinton did balance the budget, and then it got out of whack again. The problem is not that the budget couldn't be balanced. It's that they let it get out, and once it gets out, it has trouble getting back.
Mm-hmm. Dante.
I think Republicans, one of the few things that the public gives Republicans credit for these days is deficit reduction. And again, we talked earlier about why this sequester, as bad as it might be, was preferable to the alternatives. Republicans now are a party that prefer, if they had to choose between deficit reduction and defense spending. They choose deficit reduction.
Much to some people's chagrin, Kelly Ayotte has been very vocal on this.
Yeah, Senator Ayotte and Senator McCain, very vocal, but find themselves on the losing side of that argument within their own party.
That's interesting.
Because this is a party now that says we spent enough on defense in the last decade, and we need to start reducing the deficit, period. So Rand Paul really is winning that argument. Senator Paul from Kentucky is winning that argument. And people who are pro-defense, pro-national security, are losing that argument within the Republican Party. And that's a significant change.
Here's an email from Dennis who says, the consensus among experts is that the sequester will have negative impacts on the recovering U.S. economy. The reasons we are proceeding along the path have more to do with political strategy than economic philosophy. Dennis says, Republicans, in an era of declining interest in social and national security issues, are eager to rebrand themselves as the party of fiscal responsibility. They certainly don't want to be remembered for their handling of the economy under the last GOP president. Dennis says, of course, if they can forestall economic recovery under President Obama's watch, they can enhance their image as an attractive alternative. To you again, Dante, you're our political expert. What do you think? Dennis says this is all part of a broader plan by Republicans to bring down the Obama administration.
Well, I mean, I think Republicans have resigned themselves to, you know, 8 years of the president. I mean, a lot, you heard a lot of talk about that in 2012. I mean, there were Republicans going to Virginia in 2012 campaigning against Obama about defense cuts. And now, you know, that all that has passed now. I think that what is possible is that will Washington become so focused on these, you know, budget wars, let's keep the government open, that they won't craft deals that could be made on things like immigration reform, on, say, background checks on gun purchases. I mean, on those issues, there's actually hope for a kind of bipartisan agreement. But the question will be whether that gets all drained away because of this, you know, crisis a month way we run our fiscal house these days.
Yeah. Charlie, to you again, not only with Josiah Bartlett, but the former regional political director with the Republican National Committee.
It's worth noting, and, you know, I don't want to take Dennis too seriously. It sounds like he needs a tinfoil hat.
This is our emailer, not Dennis, our colleague.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Here.
This Dennis,
well, that's
I like.
Okay. I've got my email, my tinfoil hat
but
on
I think,
right now.
I think that's a little too conspiratorial. And it is, I mean, what callers should keep in mind, though, is that there is a there is, without question, there's a difference between long-term and short-term. And I think Republicans quite genuinely want to balance the budget, quite genuinely would not like the economy to stay in the tank for any longer than it needs to. President Obama, whether he gets credit or doesn't get credit, a long-lasting recession does not help anybody. It just makes things worse and worse and worse and, frankly, puts pressure on the government to spend more money. But there's a notion that we have to admit that there's going to be a little short-term problem, but if we don't deal with it now, the long-term problem is going to be worse. It's the whole, you know,
crowding out that our caller mentioned.
Well, it's the crowding out, and it's the, you know, when it's time to fix your car, do you just, you know, put a little more water in the radiator and hope you get down the road, and then you got to fix the radiator later. And the problem is we need to think about the long term.
Here's an economic question for you, Dennis DeLay. What is the economic psychology? Because economics is part about, you know, businesses and numbers and money, but it's also psychological. So what's the psychological impact on our economy, Dennis, of what the president calls leaping from manufactured crisis to manufactured crisis?
Well, that's actually something that one of the founding fathers of modern economics, John Maynard Keynes, talked about. He talked about animal spirits, which really was, you know, a shorthand you know, description of consumer confidence and everything that goes along with that. I mean, you know, on a personal basis, you know, a couple of days after President Obama was reelected and we started talking about the fiscal cliff, and that was seemed to be a 24-hour news cycle about the fiscal cliff. I had talked to a couple of people on that day. I talked to some community bankers in the morning who were very concerned. And again, this is back in November. They were very concerned about what the fiscal cliff at the time would mean for their businesses. They were talking about, you know, customers of theirs that were didn't know whether to sell their business this year or not, or wait till next year, and maybe and what the different capital gains responsibilities would be if they did that.
They were afraid to take economic risks.
They were afraid to take risks. And in the afternoon, I talked to somebody in the construction industry in Manchester, and he just told me, he said, well, I've been in meetings all morning. I've met with three different people, and all of them have pulled back from what they wanted to do. So I think, you know, again, in terms of the psychology, the damage has probably already been done. And frankly, that's the bigger danger, I think, is the fact that if you you know, with this impression that the federal government really can't control what it's doing, in fact, doesn't have any will to control what it's doing, then that just creates more uncertainty for businesses, for even for social service agencies who are trying to figure out, and state governments and local governments who are trying to figure out how to plan what they're going to do in terms of raising money in the property tax and so on. So it affects every part of the economy, and it's not helpful.
Yeah,
not
so
helpful.
There's a dollar effect, but there's also just an uncertainty psychological effect. Let's take one more call if we could, gentlemen. This is Chris waiting in Troy. Hi, Chris. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My primary comment is that we as voters do not have much of a choice as far as getting rid of these Congress and senators who cannot do their job. They put this sequestration into effect as a, it was my intention or my understanding that they designed this thing to force themselves to do what they're supposed to do.
Right.
Which they did not.
Right.
And now we're all suffering or supposedly looking ahead to these cuts. And yet we still have a deficit problem, balancing the budget, lost jobs, all these things that we've been hearing about for years, and nothing is being being done about it.
What do you think the answer is, Chris?
Well, that's the problem.
Yeah.
We could vote these people out, but who do we bring in? The people that are in now are the experienced people. What are we going to do? So we need to hold them to the fire, put their feet to the fire, and get the budget or the deficit taken care of. I've been saying for 40 years since I joined the Marines, I retired from the Marines, and goodness sakes, I mean, I wouldn't mind paying more taxes if we could get the deficit down and so that the interest that we pay on that could be put toward the programs that we are so desperately wanting funds for.
Chris, thank you a lot for calling. And let's see, maybe you, Charlie, and you, Dante. Go ahead, Charlie Arlinghouse.
Well, there are a couple of points about this. One is that 80-85% of congressmen are in districts that are completely safe, and almost no matter what they do, they're going to get reelected. And they determine what legislation gets passed.
Because Congress draws its own districts.
Congress draws its own districts. Well, state legislators draw congressional districts.
Sure.
But we draw them for political reasons. We draw them to make as many safe seats as possible. New Hampshire is unusual in that we have two seats that could probably float either way, depending on the given election. What happens, though, is that the people in vulnerable districts are given a pass by their party if they don't need them. And people say to them, look, you can take a walk on this. And when you campaign for reelection, tell them that you think we're all idiots. That's fine. And that we let them take a walk because we got the votes anyway, so we don't need you. And what happens, that doesn't happen on every bill, but it creates this difficult dynamic where so many people are unaffected by the election that it doesn't matter. He's right about what do we do, another bunch of idiots will just get in there. That's not his phrase, that's mine. But one of the things that we need to do, I think, to fix on fiscal matters is some sort of structural restraint. I
mean, like Graham Rudman.
Like Graham Rudman. Sequestration is like that. Graham Rudman was like that. I didn't used to support a balanced budget amendment, but I do now because we really honestly can't trust them to do the right thing unless they have to. New Hampshire balances its budget every year, not because our state legislators are noble, but because they have to and they don't have a choice. And we need to put Congress in a position where they're not allowed to not do their job. Currently, they're allowed to not do their job. They don't have to do their job.
Well, and a balanced budget amendment, very controversial, too, at the federal level, because sometimes when the states are in a tight squeeze, the feds will loan them money. So there's arguments on the other side of that, too,
Charlie. There's arguments on both sides. But at the end of the day, if you don't force them to do something, they won't do anything.
Dante.
Well, a couple points. One, I mean, Chris, I mean, they did nothing. But in doing so, Congress did something. I mean, you know, they did cut the the deficit by, you know, $80 billion this year, a trillion over 10 years. Non-defense discretionary spending as a share of the economy is about to hit a 50-year low. We're reversing trends on defense spending. So as frustrating as it is, stuff is happening. But second thing is, you know, you could redistrict things however you wanted. The fact is that Republicans and Democrats in this country have kind of sorted themselves out. I mean, there are lots of areas of the country, no matter how you drew the lines, you would still get Republican members of Congress from those areas because there's lots of Republicans living there. Same with Democrats living in, say, urban areas.
So changes are just nibbling around the edges.
Redistricting,
Dante.
I mean, the thing is that people have sorted themselves out, and you have two parties that are really far apart on issues. And that's why sequestration worked out, because each party's base decided that was preferable to something that would affect their particular base.
Well, and I love what you said, Dante. In doing nothing, they actually did something. And that something is sequestration, which is what we've been talking about. Chris, thank you very much for calling in. And I want to finish up, gentlemen, by reading something from Slate. And Dennis DeLay, this relates to something you said earlier. Slate says, the next fight, there's always a next fight in Washington, will occur over how to keep the federal government running for another year. Mm-hmm. The current stopgap bill that does run through March 27th, not that far away, Dennis, if and when that expires, we're looking at 1 day a week furloughs multiplied by five for pretty much the entire government. In other words, government shutdown. A lot more serious than a little nip and tuck here and there.
And you know, unfortunately, like I said a few minutes ago, I wish that we won't have to be back here again in 3 weeks, but it could very well occur because, the current crisis at that time will not be sequestration. It will be whether the whole government is going to shut down or not. I just want to leave one idea is the idea of doing nothing. The CBO did a study back in August of last year, and they figured out that if the government did nothing, we would actually have a balanced budget in about 10 years. So the nothing that would have been not done would be the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, the sequestration, not increasing automatic stabilizers to some of the entitlement programs, including Medicare. If we didn't do all of those things, we would have a balanced budget.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you very much for being here. Dennis DeLay, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Dennis DeLay, he's with the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. Charlie Arlinghouse, good to see you.
My pleasure.
Charlie Arlinghouse, president of the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, and Dante Scala, wonderful to see you. Thanks for being here. Dante Scala, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, New Hampshire Catholics and their hopes for a new pope. Catholic cardinals from around the world are meeting now as the process of choosing a new leader gets underway at a time of tremendous upheaval for their church. We'll find out what religious leaders and others in the Granite State are saying about this and what they think it means for the future. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on...